The Precinct Omega Weekly Podcast is supported by Horizon Wars Zero Dark, sci-fi skirmish war games in a fallen earth. Visit Wargame Vault at wargamevault.com and search for Zero Dark.
It's Friday the 29th of January. I'm Roby Jenkins.
And my name is Bernard.
And this is the news.
Stand by for incoming intelligence.
We've got a good amount to go through this week with an interesting topic to discuss. So let's get started. Wargame Exclusive has released a Greater Good Cyberbike miniature. The Greater Good range is designed to supplement Games Workshop's Tau range, but this piece is unusual in having no obvious mini to stand in for, although there are a few possibilities. But if you like futuristic bikes, and who doesn't, this is worth a look, even if the Alien Rider might not be up your street. Parabellum Wargame sustains its place on everyone's new releases radar with two impressive pieces in the last fortnight for their Nords faction, the Trolls and the Bow Chosen. And I have to say, the Bow Chosen in particular look like PBW is really raising their game on miniatures design. Wargames Atlantic have opened pre-orders on their exciting new Lizardmen plastic kit, which includes parts for fantasy, sci-fi and steampunk versions of the minis. And Empress Miniatures has released a new range of 28mm Vietnamese civilians, which should attract the interest of not only fans of Vietnam War wargaming, but also sci-fi, cyberpunk and ultra-modern wargamers. If my recent catching up on The Mandalorian is anything to go by, then even Star Wars Legion players might like to take a look. On a similar theme, Tiger Miniatures has released a set of British Colonials, a small team of young British officers and their local guide supported by a mule. Great if you like Osprey wargame series The Men Who Would Be Kings, but also eminently convertible for a frontier sci-fi setting. And with a more Gallic twist on the same thing, Ascari Miniatures has released new colonial-era French Foreign Legion miniatures, refreshingly equipped with pith helmets rather than the iconic kepis. Brigade Models has added to their 6mm Hammers Slammers sci-fi range with a set of new armoured vehicles, including light scouts, tanks and rocket artillery. Perfect for Horizon Wars, of course. And Kurasan Miniatures has added arquebusiers to their outstanding 15mm 30 years war range, which is one of those historical settings I would love to get into if only I had the time, and gremlin cataphracti to their 15mm fantasy range. I could go on and on, but for the sake of our topic discussion, I'll add just one more piece to this fortnight's news. Klukvar Miniatures has added a range of modular 3D designs inspired by, well, ripping off, if we're going to be completely honest about it, the Bloodborne computer game property. If weapons of utterly ludicrous size in a dark fantasy setting are your thing, well, check them out. Can you guess yet what this week's theme is going to be? Well, we're talking about materials in the manufacture of tabletop miniatures, what the options are, why a company might choose one over another, and what you might be able to tell about a company based on that choice.
Prepare for Intel analysis.
Until recently, there were basically three options when it came to tabletop miniatures manufacturing: metal, resin, and plastic. And in the last 2 years, and increasingly over the last 12 months, a fourth contender has entered the ring: digital. When I first got into the hobby, back in around 1984, there was really only a single option. It was metal. Your minis were lead or pewter, or they were nothing. Let's take a quick dip into history here. Lead was popular for making minis from the very earliest days because it was fairly cheap, melted at a relatively low temperature, and it was easy to cast. And with spin casting, you didn't even have to cast solid minis. A lot of early toy soldier casts were hollow, which saved the caster a lot of money and made the miniatures easier to handle. Tin became a popular choice for higher quality castings as it held detail more sharply and for longer, but it was more expensive, needed higher temperatures to cast, and was notoriously brittle. damage that would bend a lead miniature, allowing it to be bent back into place, would snap a tin one. Now, it didn't take long for people to twig that an alloy of lead and tin, already in widespread use in the manufacture of cutlery and drinking vessels, called pewter, was going to offer some of the benefits of each. At the same time, model soldiers began to get smaller. From early pieces that were around 4 inches tall, they quickly shrank to something closer to what we would call 54 millimeters, as collecting, painting, and recreational wargaming began to be a hobby of gentlemen, rather than of children. Now fast forward to the late 20th century, and Dungeons & Dragons saw the demand for metal soldiers, especially ones with a fantasy theme, skyrocket. And this was where I entered the scene. By this point, pewter was the standard metal, and lead was largely the preserve of the hobbyist. Early recasters making armies from a single skeleton miniature, or people creating their own miniatures from purchased moulds, was pretty much the limit of lead. Lead was much easier to buy than pewter, and vastly easier than trying to make your own alloy. But in the mid-90s, people started to wonder whether marketing a product containing lead to children wasn't perhaps just a wee bit inappropriate, and the hunt was on for a new lead-free alloy. This was a relatively self-serving project for the market, because at the time there were restrictions on who shops could sell lead-containing miniatures to, and recommendations on the packaging about a minimum age, which I think was 12, something like that. With the lead removed, manufacturers could push this recommended age right down to 6 or thereabouts, opening up a whole new market, the so-called pocket money market. Still, the hunt for an alternative metal was overall a good thing. Modern white metal is a family of tin-based alloys of various kinds, and the larger companies continue to experiment and tweak their proprietary alloys for the best possible balance of detail fidelity and robustness. But even as white metal was becoming a thing, a new contender was entering the market from the Far East: plastic resin. Like white metal, plastic resins aren't a single chemical product, but a family of related products that all work in broadly the same way. You take two liquid chemicals and mix them together. Once mixed, they begin to rapidly harden and, incidentally, get quite hot in the process. But the speed of hardening isn't so swift that you don't have time to pour your mixture into a mould. The two great advantages of resin were its detail fidelity and its cost. White metal is moderately pricey, and to make a mould you need to use vulcanised rubber, which is stiff, hard stuff. You also need some pretty industrial equipment to spin cast reliably in a mould. By contrast, you can make resin moulds out of latex rubber in your kitchen, and although a vacuum chamber is a great idea for degassing your resin mixture, it's far from compulsory. This meant that small enterprises could make resin casts of existing miniatures or a new design at a fraction of the cost of white metal castings. In addition, because the latex rubber moulds were far more flexible, you could make more complex shapes and dramatic undercuts than white metal would permit. From the early 2000s, we began to see increasing numbers of small manufacturers leaping up, especially in continental Europe and the former USSR, who were casting wargames miniatures in resin. Now, it should be said that there was a parallel trajectory to these trends, but at a slightly different time in the field of historical models. That is, cast miniatures not designed for wargames, but for display. They clung to pewter a little longer, not needing to worry about children who weren't their market. And they adopted resin a little quicker, as they mostly manufactured in comparatively small quantities. Because one of the drawbacks of resin casting is that because the moulds are more flexible and less robust, you get fewer castings from a single mould than you do for metal miniatures. In the long run, if you plan to cast thousands of miniatures, white metal tends to be more cost effective. But if you only expect to see figures in the tens or hundreds, then resin is generally the cheaper option. But while all this was going on, there was a revolution happening in plastics. In 1967, Dustin Hoffman's character in The Graduate is told there is a great future in plastics, and Mr. Maguire wasn't wrong about that. In Britain, Airfix was a household name, designing and selling complex historical kits for older children and adults to assemble, paint and display. Throughout the 70s, it was almost a rite of passage for a boy of any class to ham-fistedly coat a Spitfire in polystyrene cement or end up with the turboprop glued to the tip of his finger. Not much thought was given in those days to whether girls might enjoy it too. But the acknowledged masters of plastics manufacturing were in Asia, and in particular in Japan. Even today, despite the sophisticated leaps in design that miniatures companies have made in plastics, to compare a modern kit from Games Workshop with the designs for Gundam models or similar from Japan is to see no comparison. The Japanese remain the absolute masters of design in everything from sprue layout to detail fidelity to innovative assembly and even the quality of instruction booklet design, which is extraordinary when you consider what the average Japanese website looks like. Nevertheless, plastics manufacture for tabletop wargames became a thing in Britain when Games Workshop created their first Skeletons box set. Did you think I was going to say RTB-01? Well, the Skeletons came first, followed by the Rhino and the Land Raider before RTB-01, the first box set of plastic Space Marines, was released. To look at those kits today is an eye-opening experience. They were made from a formulation of polystyrene we would struggle to recognise, a sort of organic pink colour with an alarming brittleness that sent more than one tiny piece flying into either the eye or a distant corner or both. But the kits were revolutionary. Being multi-part, they didn't just allow but positively encouraged conversions and mix matching, and they were so cheap. If I remember rightly, and I might easily not do, I'd be the first to admit, you got 30 Space Marines in a box for £10. For the same price, you got two Rhinos. Now, £10 in 1985 was a solid chunk of cash. My pocket money at the time was about 20 pence a week, and for that, I got a comic and a handful of sweets. But even allowing for that, it was still an incredibly accessible price that made the hobby, overnight, incredibly accessible at exactly the time that Warhammer 40,000 Rogue Trader came out. And tabletop wargaming would never be the same again. But what was strange was that from that early amazing burst, GW actually went backwards, and I don't know why. The next plastic Space Marine kit had single-part Marines with no customizability. Instead, GW went back to making metal Space Marines that you could then add plastic arms and weapons to. They also shifted the type of plastic from the brittle pink stuff to a softer grey that we recognise today as being basically the modern standard, so it wasn't all backwards motion. The switch away from the multi-part kit came at more or less the same time as the management buyout in which Ian Livingstone and Steve Jackson walked away from GW and handed the reins over to Brian Ansell. Whether the two events were related, I genuinely couldn't say, but it seemed like an enormous retrograde move. And it isn't only the benefit of hindsight that tells us this. I can remember at the time people complaining about the new plastic releases and their disappointing quality. It wasn't until the new kits arrived with Andy Chambers' seminal third edition of 40K that balance was restored to the force, and the trajectory since then has been towards more and more plastic, both for Games Workshop and for the industry at large. Today, a lot of companies manufacture plastics in China, where plastic injection moulding technology has learned a lot, not to say stolen a lot, from their Japanese neighbours, and progressed at a stellar rate from China's days as a byword for cheap rubbish. This is true of most US companies like Weird Games and Wargames Atlantic, but plastic manufacturing in the UK remains a thing, with Renedra, based in the east of England, being the principal provider of casting services to companies like Victrix and Warlord Games. And although Renedra's technology hasn't moved on as rapidly as their Chinese competitors, they make up for it with better working conditions and vastly less shipping time and costs compared to China. At least, they did until Brexit. But we can't talk about plastic without talking about so-called Restic. Restic is, as the portmanteau name implies, a hybrid plastic resin formulated for use in white metal-style vulcanized rubber moulds. This means the same moulding facilities can be used to make the same miniatures in a cheaper, lighter material in a range of different colours. Most famous, of course, is the Bones range from Reaper Miniatures, but Privateer Press also made use of Restic in the course of their spectacular Fall from Grace, replacing white metal for the cheaper, lighter product in a bid to cut costs and reach a younger audience. Restic is widely rejected by serious hobbyists due to the tendency of miniatures cast in it to be shipped with warped or bent parts, the increased difficulty of cleaning mould lines and flash, and the general reduction in casting fidelity the material provides. Now, Reaper has done fantastic business in Bones, though, by pitching it as a cheap and cheerful solution to the Dungeon Master in a hurry, but also by using it to permit the high-volume manufacture of immense fantasy miniatures that otherwise would be out of reach for the vast majority of collectors. Privateer Press, meanwhile, has been forced back to relying upon resin. And on that note, we should talk about this week's news, because it tells us a thing or two. On the list, the only manufacturer releasing products in resin was Wargame Exclusive. I could put them alongside Puppets War and Strato Minis as Euro niche, small volume manufacturers mostly serving the aftermarket. Of 40k for Wargame Exclusive and Puppets War, and of Battletech for Strato. Now, Strato is breaking out this year with their own game, Hard War, based on the design mechanics of Horizon Wars, and I wish them well, but I would say that. If they want to upscale to volume manufacture, my opinion is they should be looking towards a change in material of some sort. Resin otherwise has given ground to plastic, as the increased Chinese capacity and expertise has pushed manufacturing prices down. COVID, and now Brexit, has given this trend a bit of a shock, but I don't see it scaling back substantially. For companies that want to do scale, generally the direction is due plastic, and both Parabellum and Wargames Atlantic are proof of that if Games Workshop wasn't enough. But an investment in plastic miniatures requires a startup capital of considerable size. For all the prices are coming down, the creation of the steel moulds and the actual plastic injection machines themselves are incredibly expensive. Chinese companies have managed to agree alarmingly favourable conditions for themselves in return for fronting some of these costs to US and UK companies seeking to manufacture in plastic. And if you want to know how that can turn out, look into the history of Defiance Games, Wargames Factory, Dreamforge Games, and Warlord Games, all of whom are connected through an astonishing series of deals, transfers of ownership, and risky dealing. Nothing, I hasten to add, that was illegal, but certainly risks were taken, and of those four companies, only one still exists in any meaningful sense. One of the reasons I was so down on the prospects of Parabellum Wargames was their decision to go straight into plastic, because typically the return on investment from plastic is much slower due to the upfront costs involved. It's not just about the cost of the injection moulds themselves, but the time it takes to design the miniatures, separate them, lay them out on the sprues, and then proof test the sprues. However, Parabellum seems to have been blessed with both the right kind of expertise and the quantity of capital investment required, and so far seems to be maintaining its momentum with an almost frantic pace. Wargames Atlantic, meanwhile, did a recent feature in Miniature Wargames magazine that I'm not going to rehash, but they lay out their reasoning and process pretty clearly in there, and it basically adds up to knowing their market, having deep pockets they needed to get started, and having a well-calculated strategy to grow and sustain sales. But what of the other companies in this fortnight's news? Well, other than Kluckver, to whom we'll come in due course, all the others are casting in white metal. And they have something else in common too. None of them is running a Kickstarter, at least not for the releases mentioned. So despite the opinion of a well-regarded industry observer I was in touch with recently, white metal is a very long way from being an obsolete material, and it has a lot going for it. Although it's not as home-casting friendly as resin, it's still, in the big picture, not that hard to acquire the equipment nor to learn how to use it. I wouldn't do it in the kitchen, but there are a lot of small but well-established manufacturers who are literally casting in their sheds. It's old-school entrepreneurship. It's highly efficient and cost-effective because, unlike resin and plastic, bad casts can just be tossed back into the melting pot and reused on the next batch. The moulds themselves last for thousands of spins, and the white metal material is both plentiful and relatively stable in price. Since Games Workshop abandoned metal casting over a decade ago, few companies are doing high-volume metal casting anymore, but that doesn't make it impossible. And Corvus Belli are a great example of the other reason that smaller companies might favour white metal. It provides a tremendous level of control over both costs and quality that's unmatched by any other material. With one possible exception. I can't decide if it's my business sense or my inner grognard that makes me so wary of the digital revolution. I love aspects of it. The crispness of the designs and what modern sculptors are doing with the medium are incredibly exciting. But the sheer volume of web shops, Kickstarters and startups selling their collections of digital sculpts for home printing is overwhelming, and based on my experience of watching others begin their home printing experiments, spectacularly wasteful. It feels like a bubble or a gold rush or something. Can the level of excitement and interest really be sustained? Is a subscription model based on the honour system that assumes that only a tiny minority of users will pass on the designs for others to use a sustainable way of delivering new miniatures to the market? Our enthusiasm is outpacing our intelligence, and Klukfer is a great illustration of this. Their products are dominated by designs that flagrantly copy characters from protected intellectual properties, and there is only so long that they and other companies in Eastern Europe will be able to hide behind their home country's protective legal systems before international copyright law realises that these small operations are growing. And some very powerful corporate lobbies are going to tighten their iron grip. Eastern Europe may seem impenetrable to the likes of, well, me, but if there's anywhere that a few million dollars can reliably purchase you a few key votes in your interest, then it's there. And when that iron grip closes, it will close on other sellers of digital products too, because designers won't merely have the option of using blockchain code to trace the provenance of their designs, but will be required to.
Intelligence logged. Analysis confirmed. Applying data.
Whew, that felt like a long discussion. Luckily, this bit will be fairly short. Now, I'm really excited to be developing a Zero Dark Miniatures range, and I'm excited to be using digital technology to create the characters in partnership with Desert Island Designs, with whom I hope to have a long and productive relationship. But I'm going to be predominantly casting in white metal, and I have no plans to sell the STLs. Is it because of what I talked about before? Is it because I fear the inevitable grip of international vested interests? No. It's because white metal does something that home-printed digital files just can't do. It puts me in touch with people. It puts me in touch with my sculptor. It puts me in touch with the caster of the Resin Masters. It puts me in touch with the world-class painter who'll be painting the box art versions better than I could ever dream of. It puts me in touch with the caster of the production white metal casts. It puts me in touch with customers who buy the minis and with gamers when I get to see their painted versions on the tabletop and know that I did that. I get to hand customers their cast products at events. I get to put them into parcels and ship them all over the world. Our hobby, my business, this whole industry is about bringing people together. So my commitment to white metal is based on that principle, that the decisions I take about how I create, market, and distribute my products should be based on the idea that people should come together. And releasing this podcast at a time when people around the world can't come together, it seems even more important to me that business and the tabletop wargames business in particular should be thinking about a future when this isn't the case anymore. We're still a few months away from launching the Kickstarter to put the Zero Dark Miniatures into production, and when we've got some firm dates, I will definitely talk about the difficult decision to use Kickstarter and what took me there. Until then, though, I'll let you know how our development plans are going. And I'll speak to you again next week.
The Precinct Omega Game Design Podcast is supported by our patrons on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/Precinct Omega to help us continue developing new games and creating hobby content for wargames enthusiasts all over the world.